Thank you, Milton. My name is Jack Houston, and I am an alcoholic. And it is by the grace of God and AA that I have not had a drink today, and for that I am most grateful. I want to thank Milton and the other board members for being kind enough to invite us up to this retreat. The top of this mountain is special, but it is not nearly so special as each of you, because you have touched our hearts. And if you think that you're going to get your heart touched this morning, you will be disappointed, because with the caring and sharing and love and concern that you have shown for each other, if your heart hadn't been touched by now, when you leave, I recommend you go by the mortuary, because you're dead. You just hadn't quit breathing. I want to thank my four guardian angels. I want to thank Betty for making that little grocery thing, because that was the one thing I wanted last night. I want to thank Mary because she won it and she gave it to me. The other two guardian angels I will not mention because it might embarrass them. But somebody came by yesterday and said something about, I'm looking forward to the meeting in the morning. And this lady said, don't worry about the meeting in the morning. I'm going to pray for you. Solve that problem. Yesterday, I was also sharing with another very gracious lady in the program, and she said, don't worry about in the morning. Said, you see, I already love you, and said, you don't have to say anything. All you have to do is to get up. And that meant so much to me. I took my first drink when I was 15 years old in Jackson, Mississippi. I drank a bottle of beer. I took the second one for the same reason that we all do, and it's in the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous, that I like the effect of the first one. I moved from that town back over to a town that I had lived at, and I did very little drinking in high school, but the two things that I remembered mentally, I never got enough alcohol, and physically I drank too much. I was educated in the public schools of Mississippi, and in about the 11th grade, they come around and talk to you about the evils of beverage alcohol, and they had this little table there, and this lady from the temperance union put out a glass of booze and a glass of water, and she dropped a worm in the water, and she dropped a worm in that booze, and of course, the worm that hit the water swam around, and the worm that hit the booze shriveled up. And I went off to college with the great knowledge that if you drank booze, you ought not to be bothered with worms, and I wasn't. I was up there about 3 days, and they had this big crock in the room, and they poured gin and grapefruit juice into it, and I had never drunk any gin. I didn't know what it was, and I sat there and I drank that stuff all afternoon, and that night I got horribly sick. I found out what gin would do to you. But the next morning, dishonesty began to come into my drinking problem, because I told somebody, man, I am never going to drink anything else and mix it with grapefruit juice, and I haven't. I just don't like grapefruit juice. I can tell you about my drinking pattern very quickly. I was in college for 3 months, and I got my nickname, Horizontal. If you get a nickname like Horizontal, it is rather obvious that you're not a member of the Diet Uh-huh Pepsi generation, you know. But I majored in campusology, and I loved to drink, but the two things that I remembered, I always would never get enough mentally, and I would always drink too much physically. I was always wanting more when the lights went out. Well, toward the end of my college career, the Korean War started. I didn't have a draft deferment, so I'm a natural coward. My brother was in the infantry, so I decided I would join the Air Force, and I did. And I went out to San Antonio, Texas, and I was marching in the Texas sun, and if you ever, any of you have ever been there in September, it gets a little hot, and they stopped the flight and said, anybody know anything about weapons? And I had seen a chart in the ROTC building, and I thought, man, if I have to clean them, it's better than marching in the sun. So I said, yeah, and they found out I had a little college. So after my training was over, I became a permanent party as an instructor for various and sundry things. I didn't do a lot of drinking. I was in San Antonio. There's seven military installations within 30 miles of San Antonio, and they just love to lock up soldiers out there and sailors and anybody else that's around. So I did not do a lot of drinking, and I'm delighted that my lovely Al-Anon wife, Barbara, is sitting right over here because she is the main cause of my drinking. We had been dating on and off for about 4 years, and we decided to get married. You know, Barbara always said that, you know, what is it? The absence makes the heart grow fonder. We had dated on and off for 4 years, and she said, well, Jack was always this kind of was out of sight, out of mind type person. And so we got married and moved out there, and of course I moved off base, and I had a place to drink then, and like most of us alcoholics, we arranged to get our wife a real good job and got her a job. And she went to work from 8 to 5, and I went to the base at 6 and got off at noon. And in those days out in Texas, you sat around drive-in groceries, and you drank beer at tables, and you played dominoes. And I got hooked up with the world's greatest domino player, and we drank free booze all afternoon. And then she went home, and in those 4 years, she'd never seen me take a drink. And so I started drinking, and it was, well, you know, a few beers to enhance my appetite or for some reason. And it wasn't long before she asked that great penetrating question that sometime somebody has asked all of us. Why do you drink so much? And I said, who, me? You know? I said, well, you know, I just enjoy drinking, but if it ever starts to cause a problem, I'll quit. Obviously, I was to eat those words 1,000 times in the ensuing years. And our marriage was best described as war and honeymoon, and I got out of the Air Force and I went back to my hometown and down in Mississippi, and I didn't like who I was or what I was or where I was, and I learned about early stage resentments, and I tried a geographical cure. I went that road about 90 miles, and I changed careers, but I did find me a drive-in grocery. Now, I can look at some of you and tell that you like the soft lights and the pretty music of the cocktail lounges and that wonderful country western song that says the girls look prettier at closing time, you know. And but I didn't like to do that. I just liked to, you know, stand up in the drive-in grocery and lean up against the bread rack and have at it. That's just the way I enjoy drinking. So I found this little place, you know. My wife knew nothing about Al-Anon, so she thought what would cure my drinking problem would be more responsibility. So instead of a three or four room apartment, we bought this 7-room house, and it was wonderful. I think alcoholics are the luckiest people in the world in order to survive to get to the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I was lucky. A fella came along and offered me a job traveling for an insurance company. And out in these small towns and, you know, throughout the state of Mississippi. And I was expected to entertain people, and I did. I entertained myself royally all week. Then I would get home on the weekend and tell Barbara how hard I had worked, and I was entitled to a little peace and quiet and rest. And then I began to drink, you know, on the weekends. And I thought this was absolutely wonderful, you know. But the problems began to creep in. You know, we don't all have all of the problems, but, you know, we started having a little communication problem, and I had another obsession. I wouldn't throw away the empties. I just put them everywhere, you know. And I would come home on Friday afternoon, and she'd be sitting on the sofa and the tears coming down. I knew she'd been through the house. And she asked me, said, at least why don't you throw away the empties? I have never come up with a satisfactory answer to that yet. I just liked them. I just keep them around there, you know. And one time, when they were collecting our garbage behind your house, one morning I was back there, and I heard this guy, and she was out of town, and I filled a 55-gallon drum full of all kinds of empties, you know, and I heard a knock on the back door, and it was a garbage man, and he said, sir, would you happen to have a little drink? And I said, why, certainly, come on in, and I gave him a drink, and we had one right there. He knew with anybody with that many bottles bound to have a drink around, you know. But I've heard it said that an active alcoholic will always make the wrong decision, and I did. I changed jobs and went to work for a very narrow-minded Baptist, and he did not. We just didn't communicate from the word go. I knew that job wasn't going to last long, so I accepted an opportunity to move to Memphis for a company that some of my family was associated with. And when I got to Memphis, terrible. They don't drink at drive-in groceries up there. It's all packaged takeout. But you see, I was already in the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous because it says over any considerable period of time, we get worse, never better. And I was progressively getting worse. It also says we seek out the dark, sordid places. And I found a lovely little rat-infested beer joint down on South Bellevue known as Isabel's Place. And man, I mean, I just couldn't wait to get down there. I heard a speaker one night, he described his beer joint, which was the perfect description of Isabel's. He said that his place was so cruddy that if you had the right kind of saddle, you could ride the roaches in there. And that's just exactly what Isabel's was. But it was a wonderful place, and I began to associate down there. And there were four or five of us that had to help that lady, you know, start opening up in the morning. And we would sit there and talk about these big deals that we were involved in, you know, and how wonderful we were. And at 4:30, we'd help each other find our cars so we could go home and tell our wives how important we were, you know. And this was just progressively getting worse. And we began to have financial problems, and I understand the two great financial words of alcoholism. That's loan consolidation and refinance. I've been through those, you know. But things progressively got worse. By this time, we had a family. We had this young man. And, of course, Barbara gave her attention to this young man, and she sort of got off of my case, you know. And I thought, well, that's a little freedom, you know. I began to drink, but she didn't communicate too well with me. In fact, I ended up, the only thing that I talked to around my house was my dog. That old Sam Houston there, and I would sit and talk to that dog by the hours. Telling him why I'm right and all everybody else in the world's wrong. And then I would lean over and pat that dog on the stomach and say, I'm right, ain't a Sam? And he'd wag his tail. I've never seen a dog yet that you pat his stomach, he wouldn't wag his tail. But I took that as Sam voting for me and against the rest of the world, you know. So it was really pitiful. I've heard that there's a law of physics that anything that runs on its own power must run downhill, and that's the way my drinking was. It was just progressively running downhill. I almost killed Sam, though. You know, I would come home and I would start drinking to enhance my appetite, and at 10:30, Barbara would go to bed and leave my supper on the stove, and of course, I'd feed it to Sam. Because, you know, no self-respecting alcoholic is going to kill a good buzz with food. That's absolutely ridiculous. So then I had a problem to wake up the next morning, and I had to remember what that dog ate so I could tell Barbara how good it was, you know. But the problem was Sam was getting almost as long as he was wide from eating my supper, you know. And I almost killed, they say dog is man's best friend. In my house, dog was man's only friend. And I was slowly killing the best friend I ever had over feeding him, you know. Well, we have crisis in our lives, and I could talk for hours about some of my experiences, but you've heard them all. We have these crises. My family tried to help me, but I didn't want any help. There wasn't anything wrong with me. It was you. Well, one morning I got up. On Monday, I had long since learned to drink in the morning. That was wonderful. I'd hear people say, you know, old so-and-so, he's drinking in the morning. He's an alcoholic. And I thought, I drink every morning, and I'm not an alcoholic. They just don't realize how bad you feel and how good that drink makes you feel. Your hands quit shaking and your eyes focus and you go about your duties, you know. And I was a kind, regardless of whether I was drunk or sober, I would get up and go to work. Well, I got up that morning and I didn't have my little vodka to calm my hands and my eyes, and I walked in my office and I picked up a cup of coffee and I was spilling it all over the table, and the boss came by and said, Jack, I'd like to see you. And I thought he was going to promote me and make me vice president, you know. And I went in there and he said, Jack, you have a drinking problem. And I looked at him and I said the same thing I had told Barbara 13 years earlier. Who, me? And he said, yes, you have a drinking problem. If you don't do something about your problem, we're going to do something about you. And I said, fine, if I have a problem, I'll do something about it. I did. I went out and got in my car and went down to Isabel's about 9:30 that morning, took about four or five stiff drinks, made the most beautiful speech to myself on why I don't have a drinking problem, and fell off the stool. A normal social drinker just doesn't do that. You see, I had used alcohol as a crutch for everything that had been wrong in my life for the last 15, 18 years. And when it became the problem, I had absolutely no answer to it. And as an alcoholic, if I have no answer for anything, I drink. And that's what I continued to do. And I remember that Tuesday night, he had already told me, I want to see you Thursday at 9 o'clock, and that's the day you get fired in my company. And so that Tuesday night, I thought, I better share this with Barbara. See, I wanted sympathy and cool water and kind words. That's what we want when we hurt, you know. So I said, honey, the manager said I have a little drinking problem, and if I don't do something about the problem, he's going to do something about me. And I wanted her to come to my defense and say, honey, you don't have any problem. You know, just slow down on the weekend. She said, fine, I am finally glad that you brought this subject up. See, I wouldn't talk about it. I was always going to talk about it tomorrow. And I believe the proper designation is she took my inventory. And she told me what booze had done to me and to our family and to her and to everybody else. And then I had a real problem. I had an upset wife and an upset boss. And I did the only thing I knew how to do, and that's drink. But the grace of God came into my life, and I was sitting there that night, and God put two letters in my brain, AA. I had never met any of you folks. I had never read the first piece of AA literature. Why should I? I'm not an alcoholic. That's for people who got a bad problem. And so I sat there and I tried to call, and obviously I got the wrong number because we do have an answering service 24 hours in Memphis. So I got up the next morning to go down to the intergroup office, and I thought I was well-dressed, and I later reflected I had on a suit, looked like a Goodwill reject, you know. And I went down there, and I was shaking, and I was sweating, and I walked in there, and I asked this little lady, I said, lady, I'd like to find out something about AA. And she said, fine, won't you have a seat? And the first words you folks ever said about me were certainly not encouraging. Because she told somebody on the telephone, he's in bad shape. You know, you don't want to hear that when you're just coming up like this, you know. He's in bad shape. And finally she said, well, the only person I can get to talk to you right now is a place called a Harbor House. And I said, what's that? And she said, well, it's a rehabilitation center. And I thought, lady, I'm not interested in a rehab center. I want to learn just enough. And I told her, I said, lady, I got to learn a lot about AA, and it's about 8:30. And I said, I got to meet my boss at 9 o'clock. And I need to learn a lot about AA in the next 30 minutes, you know. But she said, that's the only place that I know that can help you. So I walked out there, and I bounced back there. And Rudy, most of you know Rudy, sitting there looking like a little banny rooster. And they asked me this question, can we help you? I've never figured out why we asked that question, because there is no way AA has ever hurt anybody, you know. So he said, can we help you? And I said, yes, call my boss. I knew it was about 5 minutes to nine. I said, call my boss and tell him I'm doing something about my problem. He said, we don't call anybody. You call him. I said, I can't call him. I said, I was in that man's office on Monday, and I didn't have a problem, and this is Thursday, and I'm a rehab center, and that's pretty quick. And he said, well, if anybody calls him, you got to call him. And I said, well, yeah, I'll call him, because I was in my company car and I didn't want the law looking for that car. So I called him, and he really hurt my feelings. I said, this is Jack, and I'm out at a place called a Harbor House, and they want to keep me. He said, good, stay in touch with me. Bye, honk. And all I got was a dial tone. That's the longest day I'll ever live. When I sat down, I wanted to lay down. When I lay down, I wanted to sit up. When I sat up, I wanted to stand up and, you know, the merry-go-round. I couldn't even hold a cup of coffee. If you know, we great, just super overinflated ego, and I had to put a cup of coffee on the table and sort of tilt it over and sort of lap it like that dog back there would use, you know. That's a little degrading for somebody, you know. And anyway, I sat there and I saw real, true love that I could understand for the first time in my life. These people in that house did not own the clothes on their back, but they came around to me and said, can we get you a cup of coffee? Can we get you some ice cream? And finally, one of them said, we're going to go back there and fix you a Harbor House highball. And I thought, oh, thank God, man. This is wonderful. You know, and that turned out to be brown sugar and orange juice, and I guarantee you it'll keep you from just getting rid of everything, you know. And I wished I could tell you that I went to my first meeting for some noble purpose, like I wanted to get sober, stay sober, or quit sick and tired of being tired, or I was tired of mistreating my wife, but that's not true. I couldn't get out of that chair and leave. You know, my boss knew where I was, my wife knew where I was, and I couldn't get out of the chair. I just sat there, and the only thing I remember about my first meeting is that people laughed. Nothing funny was in my life. Somebody asked me one time, said, what kind of problems did you have when you got to AA? I said, I did not have any problems. Everything I had was a crisis. And I couldn't understand these people laughing. I can understand now why they laugh. I loved what Clark Rogers said the other night. No, I appreciate what Jim had to say, and I appreciate what Bill had to say, and I appreciate what Mickey had to say, but it's what he said. You know, in the book of Proverbs, it says, a merry heart doeth good like a medicine. And I believe in laughter is real good for us. But there was no laughter that day. I mean, it was, you know, I thought, these people are nuts. Well, I sat there all day, but they asked me the most important question that anybody has probably ever asked me in my life. And that is, can you stay away from a drink for 24 hours? And I said, certainly not. I said, I can't remember any day in my adult life I didn't drink something. I'm sure there were days, but I can't go back and put a specific date on it. And they said, well, we're going to help you. Maybe you can do it, you know. So I sat there all afternoon and think, you know, how in the world did I go wrong and end up in this? Because the old Harbor House was an old two-story rundown place that had linoleum on the floors, you know, and that type. One little air conditioner about that big in the meeting room, steam heat that popped all the time, you know. And I thought, how did I make a mistake to get there? You know, man, I must have, you know, as smart as I am, how did I end up in a dump like this? And so I sat there all day, and I went to my second meeting that night, and I don't remember who talked, but people laughed. I don't remember what was said, but anyway, they didn't have room for them in the house, and I could still go home. So I drove, and I live out in South Memphis, and there's probably 10 liquor stores on the way home, and I never wanted to drink as badly in my life. But see, you people had challenged me. Can you stay away from a drink for 24 hours? And I thought, well, it's about 9:30. Maybe I can go 24 hours without taking a drink. So I didn't take that drink, and I had already been told by Rudy, you know, when you go home, don't worry about who God is or what he is or where he is. If you have not had a drink today, you say, thank you, God, I haven't had a drink. And I went home, and before that I said the most simple, selfish prayer I have ever prayed. It was, God, please help me. There were no strings attached. I was a bargainer in prayer. If you'll do this, I'll do this. And I love the story about the alcoholic that wrote to IRS. And he said, Dear IRS, 3 years ago when I filed my income taxes, I cheated. Enclosed is my check for $200. I haven't had a good night's sleep in 3 years. P.S. If I don't start sleeping better, I'll send you the rest of it. But I was a bargainer. And there were no strings attached to this prayer. Just, God, please help me. And I got up the next morning and said, God, please help me not take a drink today. And I have repeated that prayer daily. And I have said, thank you at night. And so I went back up there, and Rudy played a cruel trick on me. We were driving down the street. I was coming unglued. He pulled in this liquor store, and I thought, oh, wonderful, he's going to get me a drink. Went in there, and David Gates, who's now deceased, David had some 20 years in the program at that time, one of the original founders of AA in Memphis. And we went back in this liquor store and had a three-man meeting, and I just couldn't understand how David could work in a liquor store. And he said, Jack, it's real simple. It's for me to sell and other people to drink. And I understand that today, but I certainly didn't understand it there. Well, the lady was right. I was in bad shape because the first day I could hold a book and read it, I bought this book and wrote my name in it, and it's 7 days after I came in the program. Well, see, I didn't want to be one of y'all. I hadn't done some things that y'all have done. Of course, y'all hadn't done some things that I had done, but I use that as a basis, you know, for being an alcoholic. I did not work like the word alcoholic. If you do not like the word alcoholic, let me give you another word. Dipsomaniac. If you will use an unabridged dictionary and look up the definition of dipsomaniac, it is a person who has an abnormal thirst for alcohol. You know, and then suddenly alcoholic wasn't too bad. You get up in front of a bunch of people and say, my name is Jack Houston and I am a dipsomaniac. I mean, this folks going to get up and leave, and I don't blame them because they don't know what's up here. If you get up and say you're alcoholic, they know what you're talking about, see? But I didn't want to do that. But they start reading the book. I would ask these people, I would ask Rudy, an old one-armed Mac, this guy that had burned his arm off drinking, had no teeth, you know, stoop-shouldered, you know, just pitiful looking. And he helped me so much because I'd ask Mac a question and he wouldn't give me the answer. He'd tell me what page or go read the book. So he taught me, you know, go look in the book and get your answers out of the book. Well, things rocked along, and the book is so true. It says we will use every form of self-deception to prove ourselves non-alcoholic. And I was driving down the interstate one day, and it was just like this. And I thought, you know, I'm not really alcoholic. I really didn't get that sick. I really didn't, you know, blow all my money and all. I didn't really mistreat my family that bad. You know, all of these rationalizations that we have. And we can rationalize anything. See, I had rationalized I was still having fun. And you know, you're doing supreme rationalization when you can rationalize that throwing up is fun, you know, and I was still doing that. But there again, you people had poisoned my brain. I had seen this program work in your lives. And I'm thankful for our old-timers that are here today, for Grady and who else is there? Jim Clark Rogers here and Howard back there, and there was somebody else. I've got them written down, but there was somebody else that's got over 30 years of sobriety. See, y'all are still... Bob, okay. Y'all are still here. You are an example. You can show us that this thing is ongoing. And it's you kind of folks that have had poisoned my brain because you were walking around and you were happy and you were sober. What is it? Joyous, happy, and free. And I saw this and I couldn't deny it. And then I realized, I said, Jack, you dummy. You haven't been this sober this long since you were in the Boy Scouts. They got something. If you think you're going to back and find a two-drink bliss, you're nuts. Because what was my drinking pattern? I passed out before we ever got to the two-drink bliss. So why do you think anything has changed? So that afternoon, I made a decision to accept who I was and what I was and the program of recovery that is outlined by Alcoholics Anonymous. I have never regretted that. I made myself some notes up here simply because what's her name over here says my memory's getting real bad, my wife, you know. But, you know, and I saw a sign once that I loved, and it says, all things come to him who waiteth, if he worketh real hard on the steps while he's waiting. And so I started getting into the steps and, you know, powerless over alcohol. I had to admit the little, you know, jug up there. I ended up on vodka because it didn't smell. I was later to be asked a question by a dear friend of mine who got on the elevator one morning and it was just he and I, and he said, Jack, what did you used to drink before you came to work? And I said, vodka. He said, thank God, I would have sworn he's rubbing alcohol. So I had to admit that I was powerless. Well, if you only talk to a dog, it doesn't take a lot of intelligence to realize that your life is totally unmanageable, you know. And it came to the second step, you know, came to believe that a power greater than ourselves could restore us to sanity. I didn't like that word. It inferred that I was nuts or crazy, or maybe I had never committed one of these heinous crimes, you know. And I got concerned about that. I said, I just can't get a hold of that. And one morning I was sitting there having my coffee, and I looked down at my den, and I had a gun rack in those days down there. And I realized that the second step applied to me because one night Barbara was out of town, as she frequently was toward the end, and I had seen this late light movie run that had the guy with the little sawed-off gun. I had cut off his movie and gone out there and taken a perfectly good gun and a saw and sawed it up so I could have one like he had. I don't know what great insanity that is, but that's insane. The law, the legal definition of a person of sanity is the actions of a normal, prudent man. You don't get up and go saw off a perfectly good gun because some turkey on television has gotten one. Those are not the actions of a normal, prudent man. And I realized that that was for me. And then Rudy told me when I got to step three to turn over as much of my life as I could to as much of God as I can understand. And that was a drinking problem. And I had to say, here, God, you got it. You know, I can't handle this. I cannot In the books, you know, it simply says, you know, if sometimes we have no mental defense against the first drink, and it's got to come from a power greater than we are. And so I took step three, and then I got to this wonderful part about step four, the inventory. You know, I found out I didn't like me. I drank to change things because I didn't like who I was and what I was. I know that I was selfish and self-centered, and I had to admit that. The best story that I have ever heard about selfish and self-centered alcoholic was the guy that walked in his bar one time, and he had this huge diamond ring on about that big, and the guy said, "Where in the world did you get this?" And he said, "My mother-in-law gave it to me." And he said, "The one who has been fussing at you all these years about your drinking, the one who has interfered in your marriage?" He said, "Yeah, that's hard to understand. Tell us about it." He said, "She's been real sick." And said, "My wife has been over to the hospital a lot." And said, "I went over there one afternoon to relieve her." And said, "I relieved her, and she went down to get her something to eat and to rest a little while." And said, "This old lady was there, and she said, 'Come closer.'" So I got close to her and said, she said, "Come real close." And said, "Would you believe that she reached under her pillow and handed me a roll of $100 bills as big as an apple? And with her dying breath, she said, 'Buy a stone.' And I did." Selfish and self-centered. You know, I had to admit that I had lied to myself and to everybody else about my drinking. You know, I came from just an average white-collar Baptist family. What little drinking my family did, I don't even remember it. So that was not in my background. I had to come to the full realization that I was the one that had cut my own throat. Nobody had anything to do with it except me. I was envious and jealousy. I realized that I had done what was in the book. I had tried to change brands, all of this stuff. You know what I found out about drinking natural wine? It allows you to throw up in Technicolor if you drink enough of it. That's the only thing I have found out about natural wines. I found out that resentment is the number one offender, that anger is something that I can't handle. I have to be aware of what other people do to me. There's a story about a little psychiatrist about this tall, about 5 feet, and there's one about 6'3", and they get on the elevator every morning. And they get up to the fifth floor, and when the elevator operator opens, the little one spits on the big one. You've probably heard this. And the elevator closes, and the guy goes on up. And, you know, finally one day they get up to the fifth floor, and the little psychiatrist spits on the big one and gets off, and it goes on up. And the elevator operator turns to this guy, you know, and he says, "I just can't stand it." Said, "Why does that guy spit on you every day?" The guy smiled and said, "I don't know. That's his problem." You see, I used to get a drunk at a lot of y'all's problems, and I need to turn y'all loose and work on the problem, my problems that got me drunk, you know, to let y'all have your own problems. I found out I was always right. I was always right. And I like the story about the battleship that had been in maneuvers is coming back, and it was about as foggy as it was day before yesterday morning. And the guy in a crow's nest calls down the captain and said, "Captain, there's a white light dead ahead of us." And said, "We need to do something." And so the captain says, "Radio those folks to turn 40 degrees to the right." And came back, "Suggest that you do this." Came back, "Suggest you turn 40 degrees right." Came back, "Urge you to turn 40 degrees right." Message came back, "Urge you to turn 40 degrees." So it went on, and finally the crow's nest calls down and says, "Captain, we're closing rapidly on that white light. We got to do something." So he tells the operator, said, "Operator, radio those folks up there and tell them that I am a captain in the United States Navy, and I am in charge of one of the largest warships in the world, and you are hereby ordered to turn 40 degrees to the right." The message came back, said, "I am unable to comply with your order. I'm a seaman second class, and I'm in charge of this lighthouse." See, you know, but I... But I was always right. In my inventory, I found out I was the smartest guy in the world. And I love the story about the four guys in an airplane. There was an alcoholic, there was a soldier, there was a hippie, and there was a priest. And the captain comes back and says, "We got bad trouble. The co-pilot and I are bailing out. You got parachutes." And when they looked, they only had three parachutes. So the soldier took the parachute and said, "My country needs me," and he bailed out. The old alcoholic who had been telling the priest how to run the church and the soldier how to run the army said, "I am important to the world because I'm one of the smartest people in the world." And he grabbed something and, you know, he parachute and bailed out. So that left the old hippie and the priest, you know. And the priest said, "Young man," said, "you take it. I've lived a long, happy life, and I have no regrets. You're young. You take it." And the old hippie slapped him on the back and said, "Padre," said, "don't worry about it. That fellow that said he's the smartest fellow in the world," he said, "he just bailed out of here with my knapsack, and we still got two parachutes." What I found out in my inventory was a good Mississippi word, and I am a native Mississippian. That's one who's been drunk in all 82 counties. But a good Mississippi word meaning no good, really no good, is bogus. Not only did I find out I was bogus, I was the plural of bogus, and that's a bogey. And I also found out that a fellow said I was a boxcar bogus. And that means if somebody had ordered a boxcar full of bogus people, and when he opened the door, I was the only one standing there, he would feel like he had gotten his money's worth. You know. And then, of course, in the fifth step, I had to tell somebody how bogus I was, and that didn't help any. You know, and then I had to look at my character defects, and I still have most of them. And I heard a fellow, I'd been in the program about a year, and I went to a convention there in Memphis, and this fellow had umpteen years, 20-some-odd years of sobriety, and he said he worked the first 9 steps of this program as best he could, as quick as he could, because he would be working 10, 11, and 12 the rest of his life, and while no two of us have the same pattern, I think it's important that mine is sort of like that, not totally, but just something like that. Because I still work 10, 11, and 12 the rest of my life, because every day I have to realize that I'm an alcoholic, and I only get a daily reprieve based on the maintenance growth of a spiritual experience. This is one day at a time. If you cannot practice this program one day at a time, I have a remedy. It's very costly. Cost you between $35,000 and $40,000, and it'll disable you for 9 months. Go have heart surgery. It'll get the job done. See, you're laying there, and you're hooked up to every known piece of equipment in the hospital, and the light goes off, and it starts saying, bong, bong, bong. And you don't know whether you're having a heart attack and need to go to the bathroom. You know, you're just living minute to minute, so it'll teach you to live one day at a time. So I still do that. I have to ask, in step 11, through prayer and meditation, to seek what God wants me to do with my life. If I don't do but one thing today, and that is not take a drink, I'm doing something that God wants me to do, because I don't believe there's a human in the world that was ever created to lay up like I did and stay drunk all the time. I just don't believe that. So if I don't take a drink, I know one thing that God wants me to do. I may not ever fully realize what He wants me to do with my life, but at least if I do that, I know I'm doing one thing. Certainly I had to make a list, and I had to go make amends to people. And that was the hardest thing in the world to do. To say I'm sorry, that's tough for an alcoholic to say. But I if I was going to practice this program and go to any length, then I had to go do that. And people were very kind and very gracious. I remember that one, I went and apologized because I had borrowed some money, and I certainly hadn't paid it back. And they said, "Well, don't worry about it. I'm just glad that you look as well as you do." And so I appreciated that. And I have to continue to take my inventory daily. I'm going to have some good days and some bad days. Our competitor, Michelob, advertises there's some days better than others. You know, I'm going to have a bad day. What's this new country western song? Some days I'm the windshield and some days I'm the bug, and every alcoholic in the world can identify that. You know you're having a bad day when you get to Motel 6 and they've cut the light out on you, you know. Or you call dial-a-prayer and they put you on hold, you know. I mean, these are the type of things that make you realize. I read one the other day, I like, said, you know you're having a bad day when you get mugged in the cemetery, you know. It's just one of these things. But, you know, so I'm going to have bad days, and I have to learn to accept that. But I have to check my attitude. When I had heart surgery, they told me I should expect to be depressed. I have not been depressed one day the last six and a half years. I'm so grateful to be alive and be sober that I don't have room to be depressed, you know. One time I had some dental surgery. I had a car accident in the service and knocked out a bunch of teeth. I had been in Provo almost a year, and I went in the doctor's office, dentist's office, and I didn't know him. And I said, I'm in AA, and I'm not going to take one thing you give me. Whatever you do, I'm going to tough it out. But anyway, this was about a month or two later. He was sewing up, and he pulled a bunch of teeth, and his blood running everywhere, you know, and I'm smiling. And he knew I was in the program, and he looked down at me and said, why in the world are you smiling? I said, I'm just thinking how much worse this would be if I had a hangover. You know, everything in life is somewhat relative, you know. I've had to accept things that I can't change. I can't control other people. I can only control me. I do this one day at a time. That's the only way I can practice this program. Step 12, having had that spiritual awakening, and Mickey said it, the hardest thing in the world is to practice the program in all our affairs. Let me give you three things. To the person closest to you, give them three faults and let them enjoy them. I've been married 42 years, and 4 out of 5 times, Barbara burns the toast. She can burn toast on light in a toaster. But I soon learned that why get drunk over burned toast? That's sort of, if you've been restored to sanity, you don't get drunk over burned toast. You just go make you some more. And besides that, I realized she did not only burn mine, she burned hers, you know. So that wasn't any big deal. She talked on the telephone all the time. And she would call my office and leave word for me to call and then get on the telephone, and I'd get this busy signal, you know, start gritting your teeth. You know, I don't know whether the house is burning down or something. You know, I solved that problem. Cost me $1.75 a month, and that's call waiting. I can always get to her, solve that problem, you know. 15 minutes before we get ready to go anywhere, we have to look for her glasses. She cannot find the glasses, especially if she doesn't have them on, and we found them in strange places. But why should I get mad at her losing her glasses? I went down to the golf course one day and forgot my teeth, so, you know, we... So, I got to wind this thing up pretty quick. But a couple of things. If you're not getting from this program what you want, think about the things that you're not getting that you don't want. You know, think about you're not getting the DWIs, you're not getting in jail, and you still got a house and a car and a job. And so if you're not getting what you want, think about the things that you don't want. Briefly, I'm going to tell you what it's like now, and you can go find that in the promises. I do know a new freedom and a new happiness since I've been here, which y'all have given me by God's grace. I do not regret the past. I hear people say, oh, I'd love to have found this program 10 years earlier. Man, I came kicking and screaming when I got here. 10 years earlier wouldn't have done me one living bit of good. I didn't want to... We had an old dog that would go jump in the lake, but when you started bathing, he'd just be like this, and you'd have to drag him in the shower. Well, that's the way I came into AA. I can comprehend the word serenity, and I can comprehend the word acceptance, and I have had to accept that. And I know that no matter how far anybody has gone down, I'm a firm believer that everybody, not necessarily can help everybody, but everybody can help somebody. And we need to find the person that we can help. And we need to find the person that can help us. I'm a great believer that you need to continue to go to meetings. going to meetings to me is important. I know there are people with a lot of sobriety that don't go to meetings, but missing meetings to me is like the guy that jumped off the tallest building in Memphis, the NBC building. He was coming down, and this window washer was about halfway down, and he saw this guy coming down, and he hollered. This guy said, "Sir," said, "how are you doing?" And this guy said, "Well, so far, so good," you know. And I said, missing meetings, what is going to happen to me? This feeling of uselessness, I feel that maybe I'm an asset now rather than a total liability. I enjoy this new freedom. I kept tending bar for my company. I did it to steal booze, and then the boss made me keep doing it to keep everybody else from stealing booze, you know. And I enjoyed it. It was for them to drink. I remember what David said. It was for them to drink and me to serve. And I had me some canned iced tea, and, you know, it looks like a pretty good alcoholic drink, you know. And invariably, when we'd close a hospitality room, there would be some clown that'd say, "Well, let's finish our drinks and go eat." And I'd grab that glass of iced tea and just chug it, you know. And invariably, somebody'd turn around and say, "Man, I don't see how you drink like that." And I'd smile and say, "Well, some of us can handle it and some of us can't, you know." I believe that my problem is of my own making. The book says most of our problems are of our own making. And I believe that some of you are old enough to remember when you went to the movies, you know, you had an usher that would lead you down the aisle and point your spaces. Well, this usher led his people down the aisle. He saw this guy spread out over about three seats, you know, and he was mumbling to himself, saying, you know, and he said, "Sir, you'll have to sit in your seat and be quiet." So he carried somebody else down in. This guy's still laying out over there, you know, and he's just mumbling to himself like this, you know, and he spread out, and he said, "Sir, you'll have to sit in your seat and be quiet." Well, the third time he did this, this usher got real mad, and he walked down the aisle, and he smelled his booze all over this guy, and he realized he was drunk. And he said, "Sir, you're going to have to sit in your own seat, and you're going to have to be quiet." And says, "I don't remember seating you." Said, "Where did you come from?" And this old drunk says, "Balcony, you know." I like to laugh. It's good for us. But I want you to know that I take this program as serious as a heart attack, and I've had one of those. Barbara was kind enough to make me a cross stitch from a sign I saw in West Memphis in a club room. And it's my answer. It simply says, "Lord, teach me to laugh, but, oh God, let me never forget that I have cried." And I cried when I was drinking, and I've shed a few tears when I was sober. When Jim was talking last night, and he was talking about the benefits of the grace of God through this program, and he shed a little tear. Jim, you were not the only one that shed a little tear. I had a little tear in my eye, too. My experience with the program of Alcoholics Anonymous has been rich and rewarding. You people have given me everything, because I had nothing and was nothing when I got here. The day I got here, that Thursday morning that I walked through the doors of the Harbor House, was the first day of July, 1965, and I haven't had a drink since. I could not believe anybody. Rudy told me he'd been sober 5 years, and I thought he was putting a con on me. Nobody drank like I drank and stayed sober that long, but we can if we do it one day at a time and we follow the instructions. I know some of you want to get out of here, and I can talk from now to midnight, but I won't. I want to read you something which sort of tells you where I am and how I feel. This is very appropriate for this section of the country, because I understand the author was an unknown Confederate soldier. It says, "I asked God for strength that I might achieve. I was made weak that I might learn humbly to obey. I asked for help that I might do greater things. I was given infirmity that I might do better things. I asked for riches that I might be happy, but I was given poverty that I might be wise. I asked for power that I might have the praise of men. I was given weakness that I might feel the need of God. I asked for all things that I might enjoy life. I was given life that I might enjoy all things. I got nothing I asked for but everything that I had hoped for. Almost despite myself, my unspoken prayers were answered. I, among all men, am most richly blessed. You know, when I said that in the beginning I was a soul by God's grace in this program, and that's true, because you, the fellowship, are part of God's grace. The book is a part of God's grace because it is my book of instructions, and anything I want to know to do in Alcoholics Anonymous to stay sober another day, I can find it in that book. I want to thank you for being attentive, and I will close with the third stanza of a hymn. You know, I have gone back to my church, and I'm active now, and I don't set a precedent. Alcoholic number three did that. But I like the third verse of a hymn known as Amazing Grace, because it's the story of my life. It says, through many dangers, toils, and snares, I have already come. 'Tis grace that led me safe thus far, and grace will lead me home. And as Tiny Tim says, as we depart and go our way, God bless us all, and thank you for allowing me to be part of the road of happy destiny. Thank you.